Welcome to DC EKG, where we diagnose Washington, D.C.'s policy diseases and provide needed prescriptions. I'm Joe Grogan, along with Eric Euland. We want to thank our sponsor, Survivors for Solutions, which is run by our very talented producer, John C.Z. Swartacki. John is a survivor himself, and he fights to make every patient a survivor, both today and tomorrow. Today, we're happy to be joined by Art Kleinschmidt. Art is currently the president of Recovery for America Now Foundation, and he also is a clinician who sees patients privately. And he served as the former deputy director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. He also has an MBA and a PhD in psychology. He is also licensed as a professional counselor, addiction counselor, and drug and alcohol counselor. Art, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So we want to touch base with you about a number of the things that have occurred over the last year or so, maybe 2 years. I can't recall the last time we had you on the show and had a conversation about these issues. The Biden administration has implemented many of its policies. There's interesting stuff going on at the state level. So I thought maybe we'd start with a little bit of your background for those people who are unfamiliar with it, and then we'll get into, you know, the policy landscape and where the country is in addressing the addiction and overdose crisis that we face. So you, before you ended up at the White House and the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration within HHS, you were a clinician, correct? You worked in Colorado, but you're originally from Louisiana. Did you begin to treat people in Louisiana after you went through recovery, or did your treatment career start in Colorado?
Thanks, Joe. My treatment career began in Minnesota. I wasn't anywhere near this field when I was living in New Orleans, my hometown. Actually, I had a quite extensive drug and alcohol use history throughout my life, basically like 20 years worth. And so after I ended up crashing and burning, that's when they had the pill mill days and the OxyContin were flying around New Orleans pretty good. I had used before that, and I had been running around New Orleans pretty good before that. But it was after that pill mill days that I went up to Minnesota and got sober when I was 36. And then when I was, I was kind of aimless, but I started doing volunteer work at the treatment center I went to. And then from there, volunteering, I went back and got a second master's degree in addiction counseling, and I began treating people with addictions and mental health issues.
So you've seen addiction from a whole host of different
types. Yeah, I should say. I started using in high school, actually, right? So I started getting high and drunk about eighth grade. Then I flunked ninth grade, had to redo ninth grade. Switched a couple of schools there in high school. Found some success for a little bit, right? It was a CPA for a while in New Orleans. And then after that, I kind of started using again. And that's when I sort of really crashed and burned. I mean, I never stopped using. And then after I sort of crashed and burned, I mean, I was pretty emaciated by the time I went to rehab.
So Art, with all that experience and then turning and being part of a system for treatment and recovery, give us your thoughts a little bit about, based again on your experience, what you think was more effective than less effective, especially when it came to kind of how policymakers should think about approaching supporting programs and ways to do the best job you can dealing with these challenges for a wide variety of people all across the country.
Well, I would say what sort of the bad part was, it seems like when I got to SAMHSA, there was almost like a de-emphasis of sobriety.
So that, just to pause there, SAMHSA, when you came to Washington, D.C. in 2017 and started working for the Trump
administration. Right. It seemed like, and there was a big confusion about what recovery is. I know they had a working group that tried to define it in the previous administration before I got there. But the actual need to be sober, to actually put the plug in the jug or put the pipe down seemed to be like de-emphasized. And then the concept of recovery seemed to be, it was always simple when where I was in my career, my life, and all my times with addiction. Part of recovery is, the main part is, you have to be sober, you know, you have to quit using, you have to quit being self-destructive. They seem to have confused that a little bit. And so what policies were really good, I think some of the intervention policies they were trying to do, just before it kind of went off the rails, I think trying to, you know, there was a push for MAT back then, and that could be a very useful tool.
But what's MAT for our listeners?
Medication-assisted treatment. So there was a strong push for that when I was in SAMHSA, and some of that could be really good. I do think by the end, they won't say they went overboard with that, but it looks like they have in policy today. So I'm trying to find some really good ones that we did. But we also, you know, worked and wrote an executive order to deal with mental health and addiction issues during the COVID shutdown.
So your definition of success for a drug addiction program is simple, as you said, which is sobriety, not using. What's the alternative definition that some people at SAMHSA were playing with, that, and where does that come from?
They had a working group during, I guess, the Obama administration, where they defined recovery. And I'm not putting down on those guys. I think I know some of them. But when you look at that, they sort of minimized, and it was like at SAMHSA, the actual idea of sobriety. Right. I got the impression when I was there that, you know, that was almost like a road too far for too many people or something. And wasn't fair that somebody could be in recovery who wasn't using, and another guy can't.
So what's the definition of success? I mean, if you're out in the field, in your personal journey, and you're treating somebody, the definition is a simple one. It's, this person has stopped, is no longer using drugs and is sober. What is their alternative, that you're using drugs but not dying of overdose, or you're using drugs sometimes, or what is it?
Well, that's kind of where they went. I mean, if you look at baseball, you know, you got like a five-tool guy. So you can look at somebody's life and see which areas are improving in, maybe which areas are not. For very serious people with a life-threatening disorder, I'm going to say you need to be in recovery. You need to be sober. Now, I mean, you can have like harm reduction type of programming, and I'm doing some of that right now in my clinical practice. So you try to sort of coach a guy along to get him into the right spot. And you try to sort of like slow down some of their using in different areas. Like, I have one guy that I'm working with right now. I want him to stop this drug, and I'm coaching him to do that, or like treating him while he's doing a couple other things, like, you know, drinking and that. Now it's on an outpatient, just therapeutic level. But I got a couple of guys I'm doing that with right now with alcohol too, can we try to cut down and control, right? So I wouldn't say they're in recovery per se, because they're still using, but I'm still working with them to try to improve their lot in life.
So making sure that people don't confuse harm reduction with actual sobriety and recovery. To your point, when you came to Washington, and there sounds like there was a lot of confusion about that from the Obama administration, were you able to, from SAMHSA and ultimately as the deputy drug czar, be able to draw that clear line to ensure that there was a focus on driving programs that tried to help people become sober and stay sober?
Sort of what happened was, you look at what happened now. Can I just actually talk about? Okay. All right. So we got this thing they're calling harm reduction. You look at Oregon Measure 110. Basically, 3 years ago, I wrote that this was going to be a very disastrous idea, and it was awful, right? So they're actually trying to repeal that right now. And that basically, or it did, legalize fentanyl, heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, OxyContin, really hard drugs, and they were allowed to carry nice size quantities of drugs. So when you and they called that technically like a harm reduction model. The same thing they did like in New York City, when you have SAMHSA put out a grant that did fund crack pipes, that did fund smoking paraphernalia and other drug paraphernalia from vending machines and everything else, right? So they were actually moving this, think of a ship. They were actually moving this way when I was already in SAMHSA. And I was working to try to head that off. And now it exploded worse out in the, I'll say out in the country, but the ship was already being steered. So when I would go and I went to the opioid summit in Atlanta, I saw where some of these people that I worked with at ONDCP and whatnot in the federal government were like seen as like, I would say celebrities, but they're well thought of. So these policies that I'm talking about actually helped to create some of this mess with the harm reduction that we're seeing today, right? So Oregon 110 was an effort to legalize all drugs under the guise, I assume, that I don't actually understand. I wrote about it. I don't quite get what they were. They're so flawed in that logic. I'd have to sort of unwind that for you, what they were actually sort of thinking. But that's why you
see. Well, I think there are. I mean, there are a fair number. I mean, two things are going on. I mean, there are libertarians who say all drugs should be legal and just let it all shake out. And then there was the, you know, the anti-police law enforcement gestalt vibe that was occurring post. You know, the COVID riots, the George Floyd riots, there was this defund the police movement. Didn't they both come together to accomplish this? You know, and let's just go one step further. You know, there's a greater tolerance of drugs in American society than there was, say, 50 years ago. So the idea that a state is experimenting with full-scale legalization is not terribly unusual, right? I mean, you can kind of see it. It didn't come out of nowhere.
That's what I'm saying. It was already a ship that got set in motion back before, like, I was even in the government. And I don't think you need to go back. Did you say 50 or 15 years when you said legalized?
I said 50, but...
Right, you don't have to sort of go back that far. Try 10, right? So, like, say 10 years ago in 2014, we were in the middle of an OxyContin crisis, and the overdose rate was about 60,000, going back 60-something thousand, right? And so today, with the brainstorm of these policies that they created, they de-emphasized the danger of drugs, they de-emphasized the nature of addiction, and now overdose rates are about 110,000 a year.
And with the consequences of these sorts of policies playing out on a daily basis, but your model and the model of many others of driving for sobriety and keeping people without continued exposure, why is it that we're still having trouble as a nation? Dan, kind of to your point, policies make it through. These sorts of things happen, and yet nobody says clearly we've got to stop doing that and we can't fund that way. We've got to be working with programs that really help people get sober, put that plug in the jug, stay away from the drugs, do what they need to do in order to continue to be part of society.
I think a lot of that goes back to they're misguided about the nature of the disease of addiction, right? There is no shutoff point for addiction. So if somebody has like an addiction, and let's say they're having certain sort of shame, underlying core issues, and they keep trying to medicate, think of it as like they have this big void. And so what they try to do is they take the drugs, the cocaine, the beer, the alcohol, and they keep trying to fill that void. The thing is, the more you try to fill it, the deeper and wider it gets. So what they're doing is they're allowing people and facilitating people to actually exploit and deepen their disease. So that's where they're going. Now, Joe mentioned the libertarians, and I've talked with libertarians, and they have a total misunderstanding how addiction sort of works, right? They keep thinking that if you actually allow drugs to go, you're going to have this laissez-faire, do what you will sort of model, and it doesn't work that way. in the DSM-4, they used to call addiction substance dependence, right? So now they changed it in DSM-5 a while back to substance
use. Wait, back up. I got to insult you. I got to interrupt you. DSM is what?
The Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Illnesses, right? So that okay. was the
so
four.
There's version 4 and there's version 5.
Well, 4 is done. It's over, right? Because now you have version 5.
Okay.
All I'm trying to say is, and what the libertarians don't seem to get is, addiction doesn't breed a laissez-faire lifestyle. It breeds dependency. And so all this thing that they keep thinking that they're going to breed and create a laissez-faire system or letting people do, you know, I guess self-destruct all they want, what they don't seem to understand is it's a generational disease that comes down from like the mom, the dad, or whatever. It tends to come down genetically or hereditary or environmentally down a family line. So you have one guy using say drugs addictively, chances are their offspring, their families are going to suffer, and you're going to see more and more of the problem. It comes down the line sometimes exponentially. So what they're thinking, that they're going to create a laissez-faire system with the libertarians, they're not. What they're actually is breeding the actual disease that's going to create more people to be dependent upon the government and social systems and not being, you know, working up to their capacity.
So
does that make sense?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Art, when you worked in the first term of the Trump administration, and Joe, I know you worked on these issues as well. To your point, we had 60,000 overdoses, you know, during the Obama years. We saw the number go up during the mid-teens, and then actually that increase ceased and began to come down a little bit. What policies really helped drive that cresting? And
so we had, in the Trump administration towards the end there, I wrote about it, but we experienced a 4% decline in overdoses, right?
Yeah.
I want to say that was about 2018, 2019. Around that time, and that's when I was mentioning with some of the MAT type of policies we were putting out there, which would be like a Suboxone. It's actually a drug used to curtail addiction. I won't splice all the different drugs, but there's like three major ones that you use to sort of curtail addiction. So we were doing a lot of that, but we were doing it in a more professional sort of manner we were doing it. Plus we also had, people won't like this, but we had an administration that was really focused on addiction. It was really highlighting addiction. It was actually, this was probably the administration I worked in that did the most. I never seen a president other than Trump who highlighted addiction as part of his national platform for presidency. So you had a lot of sort of motion going in that direction. And we weren't, at that time, we didn't have all these like more Oregon Measure 110. We didn't have Kensington, Philadelphia quite blowing up. So we were, a lot of messaging sort of matters too. It highlights, you know, the disastrous nature of addiction and all the consequences and everything else, as opposed to the messaging they're getting now, which is like addiction is sort of, or they didn't want to say drug use is, I don't know. I mean, you could sort of, it's okay. That's kind of what Joe was saying, which is an actual sort of disastrous type of message.
So now so we had the dip, the 4% dip, which, if memory serves, that was unprecedented, correct?
I haven't seen a dip like that. And I reviewed overdose rates. The only other dip that comes close to that, that I could find was, even though it's much lambasted today, it was after the 1972, what they call the Drug War Act by Nixon, where, you know, at that point in time, when you norm for population, we were about 3.3 overdoses per 100,000. And now we're like, 36. It might even be higher.
36? We went from 3.3 when Nixon declared the war, and now we're 36.
Well, it took about 2 years for his policy to get implemented. But yeah, so you would go from about 1974, we were at 3. And then he dropped it to like a half or something, if I'm remembering. And now, yeah, so we went by about 3.3 to about 36. Yeah. I'm rough. I don't have my numbers
on. So now we're losing, to your point, we're losing. And then, of course, COVID, the dip got blown up once COVID.
COVID blew the dip up, and I'm still seeing after effects in my private practice of people who are affected by the COVID lockdown.
So I want to touch on this because you and I had a conversation about this at one point. You may not recall it, but as I recall it, Art, you explained to me that when somebody undergoes a trauma that leads them to addiction or that exacerbates their addiction, when that trauma is released, those people are still struggling with that trauma. It's not as if, you know, you just turn off the negative stimuli and suddenly the person goes back to status quo ante. They have to grapple with this. So let's suppose, you know, a crime victim of some sort is using, or somebody in an abusive relationship starts using, you can't just take them out of that abusive relationship and then expect them to be sober the next day, right? You've got to provide the level of treatment that allows them to address that underlying trauma and get them to address their addiction issue. Is that accurate that the trauma
Right. That's basically, it's a little bit sort of like PTSD in a way, right? The trauma is over, but they're still having residual effects. The same sort of thing like with the lockdown. That was pretty traumatic for a lot of people. They lost their livelihood. They're stuck indoors. And we had the statistics during that period that showed substance intake like went through the roof. And you saw like all the addictive substances intake, meth, coke, alcohol, really skyrocketed there at that time. And the thing is, like with addiction, the more you sort of use and you set those trains in motion, they don't stop being in motion just because somebody decided to open a restaurant again. You're going to have the sort of the residual effects of something like that. So you are right. It was about the 4% decrease got blown up during the COVID lockdown. And I think it was like after that is when we saw the big skyrocket into the 100,000 number. That seems to be our norm for the past couple of years.
Right. We plateaued. I think was the highest at like 111, if that's
right. I think at 111, 110. I think they're going to come in around, they're saying 1.6 this year, but that's really high. Still high. That's 100,000 people.
I mean, it's 100,000 human beings dead every 12 months from overdose. I mean, that's an astounding number that we're, you take a step back objectively, like how is that not the front page news story every day, and that we're losing this many Americans to this plague? It's just an awful number. Is it, we've just become used to it. We're inured to these numbers, and it's really scary.
Well, it is. I refer to it too as like, policy by the random tweet. Nobody's really dealing with it until all of a sudden a politician or somebody will send a tweet out about it, and that's about how they're going to address it. So, like, I would actually like highlight the disastrous outcome of Oregon measures 110 that actually, you know, skyrocketed. If you look at the national experts, right, and I have, a number of people thought Oregon had solved the crisis. They have done it. They had hit the holy grail, right? And now when you go back, fast forward 3 years, overdose rates went up 1,500%. And every city that actually tallied deaths per fentanyl overdoses actually all saw an increase. So the more they counted, the more increases they saw.
That's astounding. And to Joe's point, and yours as well, terrible, terrible tragedies for every family of, you know, these 100,000 plus people who die every 12 months.
Right. And to get back to that message. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just going to ask from a policy perspective, obviously to your point, Oregon catching its breath, realizing it made a mistake and working hard to undo some of that. San Francisco, also the voters standing up. LA, a lot of localities now realizing that, whoops, that's the wrong model, the wrong way to go. Is the Biden-Harris administration understanding that? Does the drug czar get it? Are there program realities being understood and implemented at the federal level? Are we still in the wrong model here under Democrat control?
I would say they're still on the same course that they've been on. The last I looked into it and I talked to some people, ONDCP is considering, you know, legalizing marijuana. At least it's sort of being kicked around to the most I know. So really what they're doing, again, you know, you look from a drug control sort of operation that was designed to cut back on the disasters of the crack epidemic and everything else that was going on in America back in the 70s and early 80s. And now they're still giving the message that certain sort of intoxication is okay, which is really the opposite message that should be going on. I'll liken it to this, if this is a good analogy. So if you have a family and you got, you know, relatives or friends trying to intervene on a guy and say, hey, your life is going awry and you might die, you need to go to rehab, right? And everybody's saying, hey, you need help. And if there's the one guy in the room that says, you know what, I think Chuck's good. Chuck, I think you can make it. You don't need rehab. Chuck's going to listen to that guy. Right. And so that's actually now put that out on a national level. And that's basically the policy that they're putting forth. They took sobriety or recovery model and they kind of element and they kind of added it to, they took using addiction and sort of added it to their recovery model in a way.
So let me ask you this about that. I think a lot of people would say of a certain age, weed is not a big deal. Marijuana is not a big deal. It's ridiculous. Marijuana isn't legal. They've seen more damage done by alcohol. You know, there's this whole view from those who have a rose-colored glasses view of the 1960s that weed isn't a big deal. It should just be legalized. But your view is that, and that there's a big difference, another argument you'll say, there's a big difference between marijuana and cocaine, marijuana and fentanyl, marijuana and heroin. But you disagree. You think that the line that alcohol should continue to be legal, but marijuana is the line that shouldn't be crossed as far as legalization is concerned.
That's not exactly how I sort of look at it, right? So I look at the messaging of it, and they're basically saying this form of intoxication is okay. This form of intoxication is even safer than alcohol, right? So what I'm trying to say is the messaging that they're giving right now is like this form of intoxication is fine. That's really sort of the messaging that they're giving. Now, we didn't get to Oregon measure 110 overnight. Right. So we got there via legalization of marijuana. So do I say that marijuana is like this gateway drug to all addiction? I don't. But what I do think it was a gateway to legalization of harder drugs. Because once you started moving the needle with marijuana, then they started moving the needle with all the other sort of drugs. Like there's a movement to, I think Colorado might have already did it, hallucinogenic drugs, right? So they don't stop there. So when you look at like Drug Policy Alliance, which is like a Soros organization that really funded to push these things, they got there via marijuana. So you mentioned crime. So a lot of the district attorneys that Soros sponsored, one of the reasons that made them so attractive was like fighting this sort of drug war and too many incarcerations and it was ensnaring too many black people and everything else. So that was their motive for pushing this. And it started with like marijuana. And throughout my career, I don't know anybody who's actually doing time for weed, right? So they could maybe find some, but most people, unless they're slinging bales of weed, don't really get a whole lot of time. So there's a little bit of a false argument there.
What do you consider the, you said you use harm reduction in your own practice. So, well, I want to get at this distinction between, which I don't fully understand, to be clear, that, you know, it makes total sense to me if I come in to see you and I'm using cocaine and my work's a mess, all this stuff, I'm doing a bunch of different drugs, and you're like, hey, listen, dude, if you're not willing to stop 100%, let's get you using less, let's get you to segment, different time periods. But why can't the SAMHSA and the federal government develop programs to kind of employ harm reduction, to get people to move towards sobriety? Why does that not work? How do you end up in a situation where they are funding the distribution of crack pipes, which, oh, by the way, when it was unearthed, the mainstream media said, that's ridiculous. There's no way the Biden administration is funding crack pipes. Well, lo and behold, they were funding crack pipes. So how do you get from this, from the individual clinician like yourself, whose end goal is sobriety, but is willing to use harm reduction strategies, and SAMHSA, which currently has turned harm reduction into almost drug promotion?
When I was in the White House, I tried to get one of the big panels going. Government likes their panels. Enabling versus helping, right? And there seems to be a great misunderstanding between enabling and helping. So how do they sort of get there? My guess, and if I had to sort of be honest, is you have a lot of people in the federal government, especially when I was at HHS, that have really fat college academic degrees, but very few of them, and I'm not being facetious, very few of them ever worked in the field, right? So there's a complete misunderstanding from theoretics to actual practice. So when I was at SAMHSA or in the government there, I came to the conclusion after working and talking with these people, they don't understand who the client is. They keep thinking there's some sort of, I guess, there's some sort of shutoff valve that somebody's going to get tired of getting high and all of a sudden, hey, you know what? I want to go to rehab. Or you know what? I think I want to change my life around. There might be like moments of clarity of that, but that's generally sort of not always sort of what happens there. So when you're, the more you're sort of funding and feeding the addiction, you're going to get more addiction. And how they sort of misunderstand and stepped off the line. I think I actually think if you really sort of, they're almost intentionally breeding dependency. I sometimes have a hard time coming to any other conclusion.
And why would people intentionally breed dependency? What's in it for everybody else that you want to perpetuate a system and be with forethought, still at the end of it all, ensuring that that people are dependent on substances like this?
Well, I think it sort of fits a need that they would have, right? So the less self-sufficient somebody is, the more they're going to need sort of government, right? So like if you walked around, which I sort of haven't done, but San Francisco or that, you could see like within those, you know, really bad areas, they achieved total equality. If you look at the mess in San Francisco around Oregon, I was talking to a guy the other day who just came back from Oregon. He said it's a mess around there. So if you look at some of the other stuff you see, everybody there is like equal. They're all equally suffering. They all sort of equally don't have anything. So they have created a certain amount of equality with that. So whether they're intentionally breeding dependency, okay, let's say they're not, but they definitely are breeding dependency. So are they doing it on purpose or accidentally, or they don't know? But at the end of the day, that's the result of their policy.
Right.
And at the same time, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Art. You're
on. So like at the same time, right? So they're increasing drug use, so they're popularizing drug use while they're limiting the sort of the police. And I'm not like a big arrester of people, but there's a need that some people have for intervention. So as you kind of, unfortunately, law enforcement sometimes is an intervention. So I've always thought, you know, couldn't do it on a mass scale, but if you caught somebody with 40 pills of Oxy, which you were allowed to have in Oregon, that would be a good opportunity to have somebody, you know, earn an expungement or something like that by completing a treatment program or, you know, getting somebody from point A to point B, sort of via treatment. You could work on vocational skills, soft skills, those sorts of things after they get sober. You have a lot better opportunity building those resources with somebody when they're not currently using.
So,
oh, sorry, Eric, you go ahead.
I was just going to ask, Art. So when the election's held and in the event Donald Trump wins, what are the three key things you would recommend the Trump administration at second term do when it comes to drug policy, overdoses, and the challenges we face today? Just the three core things.
Get rid of these drug dens within cities. I don't know what you would sort of call them. San Francisco, Philadelphia, I don't know, New Orleans, my hometown. And like, this is not okay, right? So we're not going to facilitate addiction anymore. No more grants that actually supply users with stuff like crack pipes and that. And I would change the messaging around. There used to be a New York subway sign that was posted, you know, like a public service announcement. Using fentanyl safely is empowering. They since took that down, but there is no way to use fentanyl safely, right? There should be, get rid of the safe injection sites as well. So if you can go to a safe injection site, you can go to a methadone clinic. You know, I'd get rid of this idea that this particular activity is safe. And then you would do so you would work sort of on the treatment end, trying to get people from point A to point B, from active addiction into treatment or into recovery, into a fulfilling life. So you would do those things. And then at the same time, people won't like it, but you do have to manage the border. I mean, I could go off onto that, but, you know,
because we have so many drugs coming across the border, is that what you're saying?
That's basically where all of them are coming from, for the most part. I mean, I know they like to talk about ports of entry and everything, but you know, it's coming bad across the border. The border is divided up. I don't know if people realize that, between the cartels.
I was going to ask you: do you see this in your clinical practice when you know, as a layman, I've read about how the epidemics change, new drug products come in, new mixtures and things like that. Can you unpack in your clinical practice, or either now or in your history, where you're like, oh, I can tell based upon my client base that I'm seeing that there's a new supply coming from X or a new mixture or something like that? Can you figure this out on the street level when you're servicing clients and trying to get them sober, that there's something going on in the economics, the distribution, with new drug supply coming online? I mean, how can you tell? How does Art Kleinschmidt know that the drug doesn't come in from Canada versus Thailand versus Mexico? Is it because you're reading and understand this objectively, or do you see it in your clinical practice?
Long story short, you see it in your clinical practice. So I'd be doing group therapy and individual therapy with the guy, and they'll be happy to tell you or regale you a lot of times with tales of what they're doing out there. So if you want a quick story, this was like way back before maybe the Silk Road got arrested. It may have been 2010, 2011. I had a new client, right? And so he came into my office. I had to do my initial sort of talk with him. So he picked a young kid, like 23, 24, he picked a little speck off my carpet and put it on my desk. My desk was brown. And he said, "See that?" And I said, "Yeah." You know, he put a piece of dirt on my desk. And he's like, I would have to, that would be my fentanyl analog. And he said, I would have to cut that with where I wore like a little mini respirator. And he said, I would cut that little bit of a milligram right there and spread it over my heroin, and I would make it super strong. So you would see stuff like that. And at first I kind of thought he was kind of, you know, maximizing himself, but no, sure enough, he was telling me the truth. So it was during that time period where I was getting more and more guys that would, you know, they'll tell you, I would have them for a long period of time, you know, like they're getting this off the dark web, that off the dark web. They were getting fentanyl shipments from the dark web coming to them in the mail, and they were using that to actually, you know, make their heroin stronger and everything else. So you would see, and sometimes they were getting these really strong benzo off-market benzodiazepines. And then they had the other lingo they were using back then, you know, research chemicals. And that was all that stuff you'd get from China, and who knows what it really is. So you would see it. So if you're working in the field on the ground, yeah, you would actually see the stuff before the government tabulates it. And a lot of that is almost like personal interview, right? So they'll tell you, you know, they'll tell me, they'll be happy. I mean, the guy was going to show me, or you got to download Tor. I never did it. And he would tell you exactly how they're doing it. And then from that time, right, so that was about 2010s, you know, when I went to the federal government, they were just sort of getting hip to this thing. And by that time, the Chinese and the Mexicans got together, and instead of doing mailing of these products, they decided, you know what, we could do wholesale shipments from China into Mexico. Then they have the precursor chemicals that are manufactured into the fentanyl, the methamphetamine, the heroin, and that after they manufacture that in the northern part of Mexico, it comes across the border. So instead of doing little mail-in packages to the random kids, they started bringing in shipments.
It's crazy. Well, you know, we could talk for hours. We've only got a couple more minutes, but I wanted to end with a little bit of inside baseball. So this administration is very well known for not leaking on, you know, that they have very good message discipline. Of course, the vice president was a victim of a lot of nasty leaks against her, with people criticizing her leadership and conduct in office. But the drug czar recently got slammed in a pretty vicious series of leaks from people, quote unquote, within the administration, senior administration officials. And I'm just wondering if you have any take on this. I mean, he had a pretty good reputation coming into the Biden administration before he took the drug. He's a medical doctor, which a lot of people were optimistic about, that it wasn't going to be an enforcement approach, that he would understand the issue. What do you think's going on there? Is there motivate? Is it a personality driven thing, or is there a recognition on the part of the Biden administration that they have failed in some regard, or with the plateau at over 100,000? What do you think's happening there?
Well, for one, I don't think you'd get an admission from the Biden administration that they failed ever, right? So they're you know, that's not something they're going to advertise, especially during an election coming up. I don't know how much of that is personality differences. I do know this from what I sort of talked to some of the people. They actually, because there's a lot of Fed employees that work in the White House. People might not know that. ONDCP has it's a White House organization, and it has a lot of federal employees. So I don't know how much of that would be like personal differences, and they decided to sort of leak on him. I do know they had a little bit more freedom to do things when we were there from. So I don't know if there was a personal animosity there. I don't know, because I haven't seen, getting to your other point, is I haven't seen where anybody stepped off the reservation at all with the Biden sort of policies. I haven't seen a contradiction. I think the closest you got was the former CDC director, who said, you know, with the COVID deaths, she told the truth. It usually was included, you know, five or six other comorbidities, right? So then she was out of a job. But so I don't see too many people, you know, criticizing the administration. So my gut, without talking to anybody, it seems almost like a personal issue where somebody didn't like him and decided to leak to the press. But I can't tell you exactly if that's true.
Well, Art, we really appreciate you coming back on and diving deep on these issues and sharing both your story, your clinical experience, as well as policy recommendations and steers for the next administration, and explaining some of the challenges here that the current administration's policies and Democrats are creating around the country. We'd like to thank our sponsor for the conversation today, Survivors for Solutions, our great producer, John C.Z. Swartacki, our distribution partner, Big Wig Media, and our production team, Evergreen. On behalf of DCEKG, this is Eric Euland with host Joe Grogan. Thanks for listening. We'll be talking.